Welcome, everyone. Let me introduce you to Knut Nordby. The late Norwegian neuroscientist was an expert in the science of color vision, who also happened to be completely colorblind. He's been called a real-life counterpart to Mary, the color scientist in Frank Jackson's famous/infamous knowledge argument. Due to missing cones in his eyes, Nordby only experienced black, white, and shades of gray. He also expressed curiosity about what it's like to see color, and it's this curiosity that inspired the paper we're talking about today. But first, in case you're unfamiliar with Mary, let's bring you up to speed. Mary is a brilliant scientist who is, for whatever reason, forced to investigate the world from a black-and-white room via a black-and-white television monitor. She specializes in the neurophysiology of vision and acquires, let us suppose, all the physical information there is to obtain about what goes on when we see ripe tomatoes or the sky and use terms like red, blue, and so on. She discovers, for example, just which wavelength combinations from the sky stimulate the retina and exactly how this produces via the central nervous system, the contraction of the vocal cords and expulsion of air from the lungs that results in the uttering of the sentence, "The sky is blue." What will happen when Mary is released from her black and white room? Will she learn anything or not? It seems just obvious that she will learn something about the world and our visual experience of it. But then it is inescapable that her previous knowledge was incomplete. But she had all the physical information. Ergo, there is more to have than that. And physicalism is false. End quote. That was Frank Jackson in 1982. So the argument is not that Mary should have had the experience of color just by learning neuroscience. That would be a terrible argument. The knowledge argument is about knowledge. So the argument tries to establish that Mary gains new knowledge, new information, upon leaving her black and white room. And if that's the case, it's not true that neuroscience is giving her the complete metaphysical story of what consciousness is, essentially. She shouldn't be able to learn some new essential feature of color experience since she already has the complete neuroscientific story of color experience. And yet, when she experiences red for the first time, she does just that. So, physical information alone cannot provide us with the complete metaphysical story of conscious experience. As it's summarized in the SCP entry, 1. Mary has all the physical information concerning human color vision before her release. Premise 2. But there is some information about human color vision that she does not have before her release. Therefore, not all information is physical information. So, minimally, this shows that there's a conceptual gap between the physical and the phenomenal, a gap which factors into arguments against physicalism. And it also perhaps places some in-principle limits on the reach of physical science. There are some things that science just can't get at due to the nature of science and the nature of the phenomena. So, what do physicalists have to say? Well, they've generated a number of responses to this argument. Some reject that Mary actually learns anything new when she leaves her black and white room. They effectively deny that there's even a conceptual gap between the physical and the phenomenal. Once you have the physical story, you can work out the phenomenal story. That's the nuclear option, as most physicalists want to concede that there's a conceptual gap, since there are many arguments that seem to establish at least that much. Many physicalists try to square their view with the idea that Mary did learn something new. She did gain knowledge, even though she didn't gain any new information. The ability hypothesis and the phenomenal concept strategy are two prominent ways of doing this, and we'll be coming back to those strategies in a moment. Okay, so we've talked a bit about Mary and about Nordby, but there's one other character that you should meet, Fred. So what's the deal with Fred? Fred appears in the same article as Mary. Fred sees a color that you and I cannot see. He tries to explain it to us, and we can even become experts in the neuroscience of color vision, just like Mary. But our curiosity, sadly, will never be satisfied. It doesn't matter how much we learn about what happens in Fred's brain when he sees this mysterious color. We'll just never know what it's like to see this color unless we experience it for ourselves. The neuroscience alone is inadequate to capture the knowledge of what it's like to see that color. Just as Mary and Nordby can be curious about Red, we can be curious about whatever Fred is seeing. So let me introduce you to the most innocuous thesis ever, phenomenal curiosity. Before she's experienced Red, Mary could be curious about what it's like to see Red, such that her curiosity cannot be entirely satisfied from reading physical science, but can be satisfied when she experiences Red for the first time. This is from Philip Goff's paper, Curiosity and the Knowledge Argument. Why curiosity? Because curiosity is essentially a yearning for certain information, and satisfaction of curiosity essentially involves the relief of gaining that information. Quote, "We do feel that we can be curious about what it's like to have new experiences. Sometimes this curiosity can be satisfied by being told how the experience you haven't had resembles experiences you have had. But if the new experience doesn't especially resemble any other prior experience, then you have to actually have the experience to have your curiosity about it satisfied." End quote. So why am I harping on this? Well, first let's talk about the ability hypothesis. Proponents of the ability hypothesis hold that Mary gains a new ability, not new information. This is not the only response physicalists have to the knowledge argument, but it is kind of a favorite. So in order to understand the ability hypothesis, you have to understand the distinction between propositional knowledge and knowing how to do something. This is sometimes called knowledge that versus knowledge how. Knowledge that is ordinary propositional knowledge, ordinary facts like the house is red, the cat is on the mat, etc. But then there are abilities, know-how, wiggling your ears, playing the piano, walking, speaking, building a brick wall. These are abilities, and typically it's not thought that know-how is propositional. Someone might have the ability to dunk a basketball, but that's not propositional knowledge. It's not like you can just sit down and read a book and learn more and more propositional knowledge, just acquire more facts, and then eventually you'll know how to dunk a basketball. It's not that kind of knowledge. So proponents of the ability hypothesis try to account for the difference in Mary just in terms of abilities, just in terms of know-how, not in terms of propositional knowledge. So in that way, they avoid conceding that Mary gained new information while conceding that Mary gains knowledge. So she doesn't gain any knowledge about something that is the case, but only knowledge of a bundle of abilities like the ability to imagine, the ability to remember, and recognize colors, to differentiate red from not red. As David Lewis put it, the ability hypothesis says that knowing what an experience is like just is the possession of these abilities to remember, imagine, and recognize. It isn't knowing that, it's knowing how. But Goff provides an argument against the ability hypothesis with phenomenal curiosity. Remember, the whole point of the ability hypothesis is to avoid the idea that Mary gains new information. The reason for focusing on phenomenal curiosity is that it essentially involves yearning for new information. The satisfaction of curiosity likewise involves gaining that information you previously did not have. But the whole point of the ability hypothesis is to account for Mary's new knowledge in terms of mere abilities. The whole point is to avoid the gaining of new information. Goff puts it in the form of a dilemma. Quote, "On the ability hypothesis, learning what it's like to see red just is a matter of gaining new abilities. Either the gaining of those abilities involves the gaining of new information, or it doesn't. If it doesn't, then the ability hypothesis entails that learning what it's like to see red does not, in fact, involve gaining new information, and hence is inconsistent with phenomenal curiosity. By definition, one's curiosity can only be satisfied if one gains new information. If Mary's new abilities do come with new information, on the other hand, then this undermines the whole point of the ability hypothesis, which is to avoid the threat of phenomenal information by accounting for the change in Mary in terms of mere abilities." End quote. In short, the ability hypothesis is incompatible with phenomenal curiosity. It's incompatible with the idea that Mary could be curious about what it's like to see red. Nobody wants to bite that bullet, but if you endorse the ability hypothesis, you kind of have to. But the ability hypothesis is not the only response in the physicalist arsenal. It's not even the only way to say that Mary's new knowledge involves non-propositional knowledge. But still, it's a big deal that this major response to the knowledge argument is incompatible with phenomenal curiosity. Another popular response is the phenomenal concept strategy. This is basically the idea that the gap between mind and body doesn't exist because there's an ontological gap between the physical and the mental, but because there's a gap in our concepts of these things. So phenomenal concept strategists would agree that Mary gains a new concept. She does get something new. She gets a new way of thinking about a feature of reality. But just because Mary has a new concept doesn't mean that there's a new feature of reality. So phenomenal concept strategists would grant that there is a conceptual gap between the physical and the phenomenal. They're fine with the conceivability of zombies, and they're fine with Mary gaining something new when she leaves her black and white room. So Mary has a new concept, but that doesn't mean there's a new feature of reality that comes along with the new concept. The new concept could refer to something that you already knew about. So phenomenal concept strategists could say that Mary gains propositional knowledge when she sees red for the first time. But that's really just a different label for something that she already knew about, namely a certain brain state. These are just two co-referring concepts. They're two concepts that refer to the same thing ontologically. As we discussed in the zombie episode, I think phenomenal transparency poses an insurmountable problem for this view. Phenomenal transparency, to remind you, is the view that phenomenal concepts reveal the nature of what they refer to a priori to the concept user. The concept water, on the other hand, is opaque. It's not a priori that water is H2O, essentially. But phenomenal concepts are different. It's in virtue of possessing a concept like pain that we know what pain is. Pain is a feeling, so once you've had the experience, you know what pain is. Not going to go down that path here. Check out the zombie episode for that argument. So if you're a type B physicalist, you're going to have to reject the idea that phenomenal concepts are transparent. But you're also going to have to add phenomenal curiosity to that list as well. So according to type B physicalists, physicalism is true even though there's a conceptual gap between the physical and the phenomenal. So you can't move a priori from the fact that someone's in some physical state to the fact that they're in some conscious state or vice versa, because physical and phenomenal concepts are such different kinds of concept. Nonetheless, every phenomenal concept co-refers with some physical concept. Metaphysical monism, conceptual dualism. It's supposed to be the best of both worlds. And again, we talked a little bit about why this doesn't work in the zombie episode. So along with the proponents of the ability hypothesis, phenomenal concept strategists are fine with saying that Mary gains new knowledge when she sees red for the first time. But that new knowledge doesn't involve, quote, learning about a new feature of reality. It wholly consists in gaining a different way of thinking about a property that Mary already knew about. Mary already knew that people instantiate a certain pattern of neural firing when they see red things. Post-release Mary can know that people have this experience when they see red things. But this experience is just a new concept that refers to the pattern of neural firings that she already knew about. End quote. So, as you might have guessed, phenomenal curiosity throws a wrench in this. If curiosity is essentially a yearning for certain information, and the satisfaction of curiosity essentially involves gaining that information, then it would seem that the phenomenal concept strategy runs afoul of phenomenal curiosity as well. Quote, merely gaining a new way of referring to something that you already knew about cannot, in itself, satisfy your curiosity. End quote. So the phenomenal concept strategy, like the ability hypothesis, is incompatible with phenomenal curiosity, which I will remind you is the most innocuous thing that has ever been discussed on this podcast. Okay, so what's the real answer? Well, obviously we want to accept phenomenal curiosity. We don't want to commit ourselves to anything that requires us to reject that. One thing that can easily account for phenomenal curiosity is revelation. It's basically the idea that if you have the experience, you know something about the essence of the experience. To put it precisely, Goff defines it as, quote, "For any conscious experience, one knows the essence of C, if and only if one knows what it's like to have C." And he also defines the more moderate thesis of strong partial revelation as, quote, "For any given experience E, to know what it's like to have E is to know something of the essence of E, something that goes beyond what can be discerned from physical science," end quote. Basically, if you have a conscious experience, you know something about the essence of that conscious experience. And further, that's the only way you could know. Now just apply this to a particular experience like pain. If you had never felt pain, you would be missing something about the essence of pain, namely, how it feels. How it feels is not some accidental detail that you could, you know, oh, take it or leave it. No, that is part of the essence of pain. That's part of the nature of pain. And if you've never felt it, you're just not going to know what it is. And if you've felt it, you know at least something about what it is. So that's the rough outline of how I understand revelation. Why that would be rejected as implausible, let alone crazy, is totally beyond me. Well, regardless of what you think about revelation, it can easily account for phenomenal curiosity. Quote, "Coming to know what it's like to see red on revelation is not just a matter of gaining new abilities or gaining a new concept, but a matter of gaining new information about the essential nature of red experiences. New information that wasn't available to Mary in her black and white room. The proponent of revelation can hold that it is the gaining of this information that satisfies Mary's curiosity." Continuing along, quote, "The satisfaction of curiosity is essentially a matter of yearning for certain information. The curiosity is satisfied when the information is accessed. What we need to account for phenomenal curiosity is a story about what information Mary lacked in her black and white room and gained when she was released. Revelation and strong partial revelation each provide this," end quote. The upshot is that the ability hypothesis and the phenomenal concept strategy are not amenable to phenomenal curiosity. Revelation, however, can account for phenomenal curiosity. Rejecting revelation would help immensely in staving off non-physicalism, since, as Goff argues in Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, the case against physicalism largely depends on revelation and phenomenal transparency. Basically, physicalists resist revelation because putting revelation and physicalism together has a very strange entailment. Revelation in conjunction with physicalism seems to entail that we could know the physical nature of conscious states just by having them. Just by being conscious, you would have access to the underlying neurology, which is obviously not the case. Say that pain is correlated with C fibers firing in the brain. Obviously, it is not the case that you can feel pain and have access to the C fibers, knowing the physical nature of the conscious state you're in. But revelation in conjunction with physicalism entails that you should be able to do just that. So revelation has got to go if you're a physicalist. Quote, "If revelation is true, and our conscious states have a physical nature, then we should have introspective access to that physical nature, which is patently not the case. Neuroscience is not that easy. If revelation is false, then it's the job of scientific investigation to determine the essential nature of consciousness, and hence there can be no philosophical grounds for disputing the physicality of consciousness." End quote. In short, there's a lot at stake when it comes to revelation. But returning to the knowledge argument and curiosity, the ability hypothesis and the phenomenal concept strategy are not amenable to curiosity. So something's got to give. You either have to reject phenomenal curiosity, which is quite the bullet to bite, or you've got to reject two of the favorite responses of physicalists to the knowledge argument. Quote, "If, as revelation or strong partial revelation supposes, Mary gains new information about the essential nature of color experience upon liberation, then we can no longer hold that she already had complete information about the metaphysical nature of color experience when still in her black and white room. Hence, a conventional physicalist hypothesis is ruled out." So we haven't talked about it since it seems kind of unreasonable. But what about just denying phenomenal curiosity in the first place? Well, that's one way of protecting physicalism. We could deny that Mary could be curious about what it's like to see red, or that Nordby could be curious about what we're seeing. We're just so conceptually confused. So the illusionist option would allow you to say that. You might just deny that there is a conceptual gap. You might say, well, we can learn about Fred's brain, and just work out what he's seeing, and satisfy our curiosity in that sort of way. Now, you can take this option because it's a free country, but if you're just searching for the truth, I don't know why you would take this route. Obviously, we can be curious about what it's like to have new experiences, and it seems almost equally clear that your curiosity cannot be completely satisfied by learning physical science. You just have to have the experience, a fact that happens to be best explained by revelation. These non-radical middle ground forms of physicalism are untenable in light of phenomenal curiosity. As Goff points out at the end of his paper, quote, either we accept phenomenal curiosity and are led to views which oppose conventional physicalism, such as dualism or Russellian monism, or we deny phenomenal curiosity and are led to illusionism, or at least the denial of even a conceptual distinction between the mental and the physical. The middle ground of moderate physicalism, I suggest, is not sustainable. End quote. Moderate physicalists meaning the proponents of the ability hypothesis and the phenomenal concept strategy. The people who want to say, yeah, Mary gains new knowledge, but it's still not a threat to physicalism because she either just gains a new bundle of abilities, she gains know-how but not knowledge of that, or she basically slaps a new label on information she already had. Phenomenal curiosity throws a wrench in that. If Goff is right, then we have to make a choice. Not between non-physicalism and physicalism, but between non-physicalism and the most radical forms of physicalism that even most physicalists don't want to entertain. And since we're at the end here, let me remind you of what phenomenal curiosity is. Quote, before she's experienced red, Mary could be curious about what it's like to see red, such that her curiosity cannot be entirely satisfied from reading physical science, but can be satisfied when she experiences red for the first time. Regardless of which direction this sends you in, revelation can account for what information she lacked in her black and white room and what she gained when she was released. It can account for what we lack that Fred has, for what Nordby lacks that we have. Non-physicalists love to play this game of name the most innocuous possible thing that physicalists will still say they don't agree with or just can't understand. I like this paper because I think this might be the new high score. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.